Welcome to Good For You Radio. I'm Claire Carter, founder of the Good For You Network, which is all about news and information that is good for you to know about, that affects every aspect of your well-being, meaning your health, healing, happiness, prosperity, and peace of mind, as well as the well-being of our nation and world. You may know what kind of gasoline to put in your car so it will operate at peak performance. But can you honestly say you're doing everything you can to make sure that your own body's engine works optimally? In part one of our conversation with Dr. Mark Luponis, Corporate Medical Director of Canyon Ranch, one of the world's leading health resorts and spas, we talked about the one thing heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and Alzheimer's all have in common, and that is inflammation and what we can do to reduce our inflammation levels and prevent us from getting those diseases. Mark Luponis, welcome back to Good For You Radio.
Thanks, Claire. It's great to be back with you.
You gave us so much good information to think about, and I wanted to share with the listeners. This was a Friday afternoon when we were taping. This is 3 days later, a Monday afternoon. And when I went home Friday night, I got a call from a friend of mine. A friend of hers had called her, all distraught. Her friend is dealing with cancer. And her integrative medicine oncologist, one of the best known, most highly respected oncologists, Dr. Mitch Gaynor, she learned had just died. And there was, I think, the shock, the suddenness, the sadness for his family and for all of his patients, Mark. And I also know that so much of what we talked about in part one were things that Dr. Mitch Gaynor believed in, and you as well recommended patients routinely to Dr. Gaynor.
Yeah, and it's just so tragic.
Well, over the weekend, in addition to reeling from all of this, and I know so many people who know him, so many lives that he's extended or saved over the years, I started reading interviews that he had done, one from 1999, one recently within the last month or so. And I wanted to quote some of the things that he had said and then talk to you about it, Mark, as our way of honoring his legacy, because he had so many good things to say. He was a doctor conventionally trained who also embraced the best of integrative medicine. He said that he studied at Rockefeller University. And one of his quotes was, "It's very important for people to realize that this disease, which we call cancer, is the result of a decades-long process, and that nutrition is a way of thwarting each step of that process." And another quote was, "I was amazed at the fact that we really are what we eat, and that with the best medical training in the world, nobody had ever taught me this." Mark, your reaction was the same in terms of medical school, that when did it sink in the important role of nutrition? And here was Mitch Gaynor talking about it.
No question. And it's sad to see so many doctors that really don't focus on nutrition or don't have the training that they need to be able to give people advice about ways to improve their diet. And I agree, if there's one thing that we can do to change our health for the better quite easily, it's to improve the quality of our diet. And I totally agree with Mitch on that.
Well, his most recent book, I mean, his earlier book with Dr. Gaynor's book was Cancer Prevention Program. I think it came out in the spring, was the Gene Therapy Plan. And he said that it was when he got a fellowship at Rockefeller University that he was doing research on the immune system and genes as they relate to cancer. And he said, quote, "I was literally flabbergasted to see that there were nutrients that could increase tumor promoter genes along with the many things that make up our average American diet, such as, remember we talked about in part one, the white sugar, the white flour, the heat-damaged vegetable oils, the processed grains, the pesticides, the herbicide residues." This was like his wake-up call in doing genetic research that this played a part. And in those days, years ago, that wasn't conventionally accepted, was it?
No, I mean, I completely agree. And actually, I'm reading a book right now, Food, Genes, and Culture, about how we've evolved with our indigenous diets. And that it's scary because if Americans are going to evolve with the current American diet, we're in for trouble.
Well, we're in for trouble if you consider, I think it's like $1 trillion that are being spent these days on chronic diseases in America. I mean, a lot of chronic diseases are preventable, are they not?
For sure. I mean, think about the things like, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, many forms of cancer could be preventable with changes in diet, all of the digestive issues that people are dealing with, it's rampant.
What were the things that Mitch Gaynor was saying that his patients should take? Because he believed, in addition to doing chemotherapy, he would prepare people with IVs of something called glutathione, as well as vitamin C. What can that do for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, Dr. Gaynor had the idea that some supplements could complement the therapy that was being administered, that whether people were going through a surgical approach or they were taking chemo or radiation, that there might be some nutrients, a diet, or some supplements that might help them to have a better outcome or to reduce the symptoms that they're experiencing, and I think that's certainly true. If you think about the class of supplements as being weak complementary medicines, when they're given together, they can actually contribute to a better effect. And that's a good use of the supplements, if as long as they're used properly. And like all things, we have to understand what effects they can produce, potentially what side effects might occur, and then in what situations they might be very helpful. You know, we were talking about inflammation, and some of the things that I found to be quite helpful for that are some simple things like the turmeric spice, which, you know, they make into curry. Very helpful at blocking and reducing inflammation. That's one, you know, good example. Some of the fish oils like DHA is very helpful at lowering levels of inflammation.
Let's go over these things one by one, because turmeric is one on the list of Dr. Gaynor. Turmeric, I understand, is anti-infection, anti-inflammation. Do they know how it works?
It seems to inhibit this inflammatory chemical called tumor necrosis factor alpha. This is one of the effects of turmeric, and it may have others, but that's a very critical inflammatory, we call it cytokine, made by the immune system. And the immune system probably uses it to trigger a healing response in cases where somebody has an infection, for example. But in other cases, for example, with autoimmune diseases or with cancer, it can actually make things worse. And that's where turmeric can play a very important role in helping to reduce the levels of inflammation, and that's a great use of turmeric.
You know, it was interesting. One of the things I also read, Dr. Gaynor had said turmeric prohibits cell or cell development in 25 different ways. Cancer cells, I mean.
Yeah, there are a number of effects of turmeric. Another one, and it may be helpful with men and prostate cancer, because it helps to block the hormones in the body that stimulate the growth of the prostate. And that may be helpful, especially in, you know, middle age and older men, and they may get a benefit from taking something like turmeric. We also think it may have an effect on memory. And there are some studies going on now with turmeric, for example, and Alzheimer's, to see if turmeric supplements may help.
There's other things that he talked about. And not, we should acknowledge that maybe not every oncologist would be as much of a fan of supplements as he was.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of physicians, namely because there's not enough research and enough education about how these supplements are actually working inside the body. And I think there's a concern also that we may not fully understand how they interact with the treatment that somebody's getting. And, you know, that can make doctors nervous. I think Mitch was different because he had such a deep understanding of how these herbs worked. He was much better at being able to create programs that could be of help because of that deep understanding.
Well, he also, and I want to quote from Dr. Gaynor, he said, "I used to think our genetic destiny was mostly fixed. For instance, if a person had a strong family history of diabetes, it was their destiny. And then epigenetics really turned things around because it showed that our genes are dynamic and they can be changed during our lifetime by what we put into our bodies, either for good or for worse." I mean, that is really thought-provoking.
It is, and it's the idea that our ancestors may have had a lifestyle that changed their genes, and that lifestyle can be passed on through these so-called epigenetic changes in the DNA. It doesn't have to be a mutation. It might have to do with just the lifestyle that somebody was leading. If they, for example, were drinking too much alcohol, or let's say they were eating a poor diet, maybe there was too much sugar in the diet, that might actually cause changes in the genes that can be passed on to the next and subsequent generations. Mm-hmm. This is this idea of epigenetics.
You explain that word, Mark, epigenetics.
Epi just means on top of. So on top of the genes, we've got changes that occur in the individual. And once those genes have been altered, the alterations can be transmitted to the next generation. So things like diet and lifestyle, cigarette smoking is a common one where cigarette smoking may alter the genes and that could be passed on to subsequent generations. The way that we eat, you know, if we're eating, you know, too much refined food or processed junk foods, that actually might change our genes in a way that can affect our offspring.
So it can't hurt to maintain a healthy diet, but it can hurt us to eat the junk foods and the processed foods on a regular basis.
Well, sure. The point is that it doesn't just hurt us. It might be a have an effect on our offspring as well, both for the father and for the mother. And so it's not just that we're putting ourselves at risk. We're putting the next generation at risk.
You know, isn't that an interesting thing to think about? Because no parent would say, I want to do anything to harm my child in any way. But as you brought up in part one of our conversation, even before you get pregnant, you need to be thinking about what are you putting into your body? As I said at the top, your body's engine, in a sense, what kind of fuel are you putting in?
That's right.
Garlic, I know, is good for you. And one of the things Dr. Gaynor talked about is that garlic induces, and I had not heard this word before, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, apoptosis? A-P-O-P-T-O-S-I-S?
Sure. That's the so-called programmed cell death. It's the idea that when a cell is aging and it's time for it to leave the body, there's a process for that allows the cell to be, to die and to be recycled so that the parts are used again. In certain cases, like in cancer, for example, there's a lack of that normal cell aging. Mm-hmm. And that lack of cell aging is, we think, one of the pivotal reasons that cancer can continue. And if we can allow this, the apoptosis...
It's a hard word. It's a really
hard
one.
then we may have better results with cancer care. And I think, Mitch was very focused on that.
Well, he was saying something like garlic can help keep the cancer cells dormant. Is it true we all have precancerous cells in us, but we want to keep them dormant for our lifetime?
Well, certainly as we get older, we may accumulate more cancerous cells. Most of those don't turn into cancer because they're taken out of commission by the immune system or for some reason they don't have what's required to become an active growing tumor. And we think that's probably more common than people are aware of. For example, they've done autopsy studies and they found at autopsy that about a third of people, if you examine very carefully, mm-hmm. might have microscopic cases of cancer, for example, in the thyroid. Or in men in the prostate gland. They didn't die from it, but they died with it, let's say. And it turns out that the presence of microscopic cancer in the body is not uncommon. There may be a number of reasons why that cancer doesn't turn into a lethal, fatal problem. A lot of that has to do with how we live our lives, and that is, are we active? Are we fit? Are we giving our immune system the best chance to help us?
Well, that's like with men with prostate cancer, where sometimes just watchful waiting is okay because it's such a slow-growing cancer.
That's always the trick, is to understand...
For some men, anyway.
Slow-growing cancer versus rapidly growing. And, I'm sorry to say that we haven't figured that out yet. It's hard to know which men need more aggressive treatment. And that's, hopefully something we'll figure out in the next couple of years here.
Part of being the CEO of your own well-being is getting the information, being well-informed, taking the C-reactive protein test that we talked about in part one that will give you an idea of where your inflammation levels are.
Sure. I mean, that may give you a heads up to understand that there's something brewing before you have a symptom. And if you can work with your doctor to track down the reason that the C-reactive protein might be high, you might find something that you didn't expect that was, unsuspected. And I think that's valuable.
So that test, C-reactive protein, for let's say somebody, not just with cancer, but let's say heart disease, that could be even more important sometimes than even your cholesterol levels if you've got a lot of inflammation that's not being addressed for years on end.
Well, we know that inflammation works with cholesterol to make the situation more dangerous. In other words, high cholesterol by itself is not nearly as dangerous as the combination of high cholesterol and inflammation. That's when we really have a dangerous situation.
Also, just mentioning cholesterol, people hear their total number and they go, I'm over 200. But they don't necessarily know about not only what HDL versus LDL, but you are a believer in what's called an LDL particle size test. Explain why it's important for people to know the size of their LDL, what we consider the, quote, bad cholesterol.
You're right, and that is cholesterol has gotten more complicated. It's not just the total number anymore. There's a breakdown of cholesterol with the different types of cholesterol. And what's going on is the body is actually packaging cholesterol in different types of packets depending on the need and the use. For example, LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, transports cholesterol from the liver out to the blood vessels where it can collect as plaque. And it turns out the smaller and the denser those LDL particles are, the more dangerous they are. The larger and the more buoyant, or let's say less dense they are, the less likely they are to accumulate as plaque. And now we have tests that will tell us the size of the particles and their density. And that's quite helpful in being able to make predictions about whether someone, you know, is at risk or not.
Well, I remember watching Dr. Oz one day, and he was doing a thing on cholesterol, and he showed the big, fat, fluffy particles of LDL, and he showed the arterial walls and the way they bounced off from side to side, like a tennis ball going from side to side. So before a doctor prescribes medication or anything else, should they not be doing that test and know what we're talking about as far as what size are your particles?
It'd be important to do. I think what happens a lot of times is, you know, doctors see numbers that scare them and they, you know, try to encourage the patient to take treatment and their patient to take treatment. But, you know, that may not be the whole picture. If you need a more complete picture, you'd have to, for example, check the levels of inflammation by measuring the C-reactive protein level. And you'd want to see what the size of the LDL particles are. And you'd like to know how much of the good cholesterol there is that's counteracting the bad cholesterol. And all of those are important factors in making a decision about, you know, how concerned we should be and how much treatment somebody needs.
So what would be a good number? What would be a good ratio between HDL and LDL? Like how high should your HDL be versus, you know, your LDL?
It varies in men and women generally tend to have a better HDL level than men. And I think for women, the HDL ideally should be at least a third of their total cholesterol. So that means if you've got an HDL, let's say, of 80, you could have a total cholesterol as high as 240 without generally being concerned. Again, that's especially as long as the inflammation level is low.
Inflammation level low and big, fat, fluffy particles of LDL.
Sure. That's a very safe situation. I wouldn't be concerned. Now, if in men, it's less common to have the HDL being a third or more of the total cholesterol. And generally speaking, if men can get their HDL level to be more than a quarter of their total cholesterol, then that's probably a pretty good range for men to be in.
But it really pays to check these things out and to know what questions to ask your doctor if you didn't know about ratios between HDL, LDL. If you never heard about an LDL particle size test, then you're just looking at a number. You might get scared and immediately think, oh, I got to do something. And not to say you shouldn't do something about diet, exercise, nutrition, but maybe medication is not the first answer.
Right. And, you know, in my experience, doctors are so excited and interested when they find out that their patient actually is taking an interest in their cholesterol, asking about it, and do I need to take something or should it be lower and how can I improve my numbers? I mean, generally speaking, if a patient expresses interest, you know, we're very happy about that because we'd love to help teach, you know, how to eat better and how to get the HDL up, getting more exercise and how to lower that LDL and get more fiber and all the things that we know can help. And if somebody expresses an interest in that, then, you know, we'll just jump right on that and help them out. But, you know, unfortunately, too often people don't take an interest in their health. And then it's the doctors trying to beat them up to do the right thing. And that's a much tougher situation.
And also, you want to have the kind of doctor that's actually excited about the fact that you're learning and asking questions. I remember years ago having dinner with somebody who said her doctor fired her. And I go, what do you mean your doctor fired you? She said, yeah, he wanted me to take a statin drug and she didn't feel her cholesterol levels were that high and they weren't. I said, well, then maybe it's good you find another doctor because she really was somebody and the levels weren't that high. It wasn't more than 220. But I didn't know what her HDL was versus LDL. Did she take an LDL particle size test? You're saying, you know, did she have C-reactive protein inflammation? I don't know. But you got to find the right fit with doctor. Let's talk about another supplement that Dr. Gaina really believed in and to have your vitamin D3 levels checked. How low levels can increase the chance of developing cancer and other diseases of vitamin D3?
Yeah, vitamin D, you know, which is actually not really a vitamin because technically, a vitamin is defined as a nutrient that our body needs but can't produce, and that's not true with vitamin D. Our body makes vitamin D, but only when it's exposed to sunshine. In other words, we've got to be out in the sun to make vitamin D. Our skin will manufacture it. And if we were to go down into the beach or play mm-hmm. around a golf outdoors, well, our body would generally make about 10,000 units of vitamin D3 per day. And that's a very sunny day, and you know, in the summer season. So we think that's about the limit of daily intake. In some places, for example, if you're north of Atlanta in the fall or winter, there's not enough sunshine to make vitamin D. So most people that live north of Atlanta in the winter months will become deficient in D if they're not taking a supplement. Part of the problem is we still don't know the, let's say, optimal level of vitamin D for various health conditions. There may be a difference in the target for vitamin D depending on the condition that we're trying to prevent. And in Dr. Gaynor's situation, of course, he was dealing mostly with cancer patients, and that's probably where higher doses of vitamin D are more effective. And so for cancer prevention, maybe we're shooting for levels of vitamin D that are 50 or above, whereas for cardiovascular disease prevention, we might target a lower level, closer to 30.
What is considered? So 30, 50 is considered normal. What would be considered low vitamin D or extreme low vitamin D?
Well, single digits. If you're, less than 10, that's considered severe deficiency. Between 10 and 20 is considered moderate. Between 20 and 30 is mild or borderline. And then we think 30 to 100 is the therapeutic range. But again, where you want to be in that range, might vary depending on the issues that you're dealing with.
So if you're low on vitamin D, somebody had asked me this question recently. His doctor wanted him to take a large dose of vitamin D. How much do you want to take? Because you don't want to take too much every day, because that may not be good either.
Well, vitamin D is actually one of the fat-soluble vitamins, meaning it dissolves in fat as opposed to in water. And there are four fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin A, D, E, and K. And that means that the levels of vitamin D change more slowly in your system when it's fat-soluble. And when people are carrying extra fat, the fat will act like a sponge and soak up the vitamin D. So it will be really hard to get a therapeutic blood level of vitamin D if somebody is obese, because the fat is acting like a sponge soaking up that vitamin D. And so that's a situation where people would be on a higher dose. If someone is quite thin and doesn't have a lot of fat, then they might be able to get by without a supplement at all. In other words, just sun exposure might do it for those people.
And yet you're concerned too much sun exposure and you could be increasing your risk for skin cancer.
Like everything, it's a balancing act, right? You want enough, but not too much. And, that's that magic Goldilocks situation that we're always talking about. And that is, we don't want it too hard. We want it, or too soft. We want it just right. We don't want it too high or too low. We want it just right. And that's the human body. We want Goldilocks on a lot of things, and vitamin D is certainly one of those things.
Let's hear it for Goldilocks. But if you put on the SPF 30, 40, 50, that's preventing some of that wonderful vitamin D from getting absorbed. And
well, yeah, the D will block sun block also blocks the D production. So you'll need to get a little bit of sun without the D if you want to produce vitamin D from the sun. Now, my dermatology friends disagree with me. They believe that we should get all the D we need from a supplement as opposed to getting the risk of skin cancer and wrinkles, et cetera. And, I understand their point, but there is probably, again, a Goldilocks place where you can get just enough but not too much sun and be safe.
Well, the old adage is just because a little bit of something is good doesn't mean a whole lot more is better. I've heard that so many times and I've said it so many times. But you have to find that right balance in that. When we talk about, talking about Dr. Gaynor and people and diet, good diet, not diet. At one point, he had done what he calls the rule of thirds as far as diet. He was concerned that most of these fad diets lead you to be deficient in certain nutrients. Would you agree with that?
Well, sure. I mean, if you're cutting out a large food group, it's certainly likely or highly possible that there may be a nutrient that's missed in that food group if you're cutting out, whatever the case might be. People are cutting out carbs or they're cutting out fat. And whatever you're restricting in the diet, there may be a deficiency associated with that restriction. Sure. Like, for example, vegans, it's hard to get enough B12 if you're eating a vegan diet because B12 is really only found in animal products. And so that's a situation where a supplement might be needed.
Well, his one-third diet were the things that we talked about really in part one of our conversation. He said one-third of the calories from healthy protein. So he was talking eggs, raw veggies, lentils. You said you love lentil soup.
I do.
And lean meat. And then one-third from healthy carbs, the whole grains. And we had talked about even the sprouted whole grains, why they might be even better than whole grains.
Sure.
Sprouted whole grains have more vital nutrients in it.
I like it.
Fruit. And then there was something I had never heard. He included Swiss cheese, and I had never heard of that. I was always thinking cut down on cheeses, but I never heard there was anything special in Swiss cheese.
Well, I mean, the Swiss have a long tradition of making cheese. Maybe they're just the best at it.
I don't know. And then there was one-third of healthy fats, the omega-3 fats. We had mentioned in part one, the cold, deep-water fish. I know, in addition to wild salmon, which I love, which you either get in a can or buying the wild Alaskan salmon, there is a form of salmon. It's a white salmon. And it's a species of salmon that feeds off of little herrings. So I've always thought that's even better. And it tastes more like a whitefish.
Well, sounds yummy.
Yes. And then it is yummy, especially the way I make it. I do olive oil, lemon juice. I brush it with like a good barbecue sauce. I like there's a brand called Organicville, their barbecue sauce. And then I add garlic gomazio. Eden's makes a form of garlic gomazio, which is sesame seeds and garlic and low sodium, Mark. So that part is good. And then I'll saute it and it is absolutely, or you can broil it, absolutely delicious. And the lemon juice just gives it that added flavor and it's juicy. And I love the flavor of just a little bit of a barbecue sauce. And I happen to like the seasoning garlic gomazio because you have to eat stuff that tastes good to you. Otherwise,
you're making me hungry.
Yeah, right. Well, if it tastes like medicine, it's like steamed broccoli. I mean, I can eat broccoli as long as I saute it and do some olive oil and lemon juice and garlic gomazio. But when it's just plain steamed, it just tastes too medicinal. You know, I want to do something to it. And so the olive oil, why olive oil is so important?
Well, I mean, olive oil being, you know, one of the healthier forms of oils, it's a monounsaturated fat, which is one of the healthier ones. We think that it's also decent for cooking because it doesn't decompose at high heat, so it's suitable for most cooking purposes. It does have some flavor, so if you're baking, it may be a challenge. But olive oil, we believe, also has a benefit on the cardiovascular system and may help prevent some forms of cancer. Most recently, a good study showing adding olive oil to women's diets reduced the risk of breast cancer significantly. And so that's something worth, you know, it's easy to do. It's something that you could easily shift from a safflower, corn, or sunflower oil to using more olive oil.
When you say about reducing the risk of breast cancer, one of the things, you know, I became aware of years ago was the importance of cruciferous vegetables.
Sure.
What is the chemical that's in the cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, bok choy, Brussels sprouts?
Yeah, that's a category of foods that seems to help the liver to do its job a little bit better in processing the hormones that our body produces. And it seems to be the sulfur-based amino acids found in those foods. So that's why that category of food smells kind of funny, like broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and cabbage. They have that sort of funny sulfur-like smell, and that's, we think, where the therapeutic benefit comes from, some of these sulfur-containing compounds that are found in those foods.
So something like cruciferous vegetables and the chemical, it's called DIM for short. What is the full name of it?
DIM is diindolylmethane, which is a supplement that's taken from an extract of the cruciferous vegetables. And now people are studying diindolylmethane, DIM, as a supplement in preventing breast cancer. And there seems to be, you know, potentially some value there. It obviously needs more study, but it's something that I've recommended in the past as a way to help women to reduce their risk.
Because it helps you to properly metabolize estrogen, correct?
Estrogen and some of the other, you know, sex hormones that are produced by the ovaries and also in other tissues of the body. So, yes.
So that's good for preventing female cancers, but also for men, the relationship to prostate cancer in men.
There's probably also a benefit for prostate cancer. You're right. Again, in helping men to be able to detoxify the unwanted forms of hormones.
There's so much to learn about. One of the other things that Dr. Gaynor talked about was the wrong bacteria in your gut, why you want to make sure you have plenty of the good bacteria. So let's talk about the gut.
Yeah, there's a lot of bacteria there. I mean, they think there's probably 100 trillion different bacteria, or at least numbers of bacteria.
Wait a minute, 100 trillion?
100 trillion and over 1,000 species, probably only 100 of which they've ever even really identified. So there's, it's like the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, you know, there's a lot we don't know about down there.
I want to make friends with my 100 trillion bacteria. How do I do that?
You want 100 trillion friendly bacteria.
Yeah, friendly.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, mostly about getting the right diet. You know, when we're eating a healthy diet, it tends to feed the bacteria that we want. You can imagine what happens when we are just eating a lot of junk food and sugary foods and fat to the bacteria in the gut, and that is the wrong ones start to grow at that point. We're really starting to learn more about this, but haven't, you know, figured out which specific bacteria we might want. We're more at, let's say, the categories of bacteria that seem to be more beneficial.
When people take a lot of antibiotics, let's even talk about small children, when they get a lot of antibiotics. The antibiotics obviously being taken for a bacterial, not a viral infection, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it's killing off the bad bacteria, but it also kills off your good bacteria.
Well, it will kill any bacteria that are, let's say, susceptible to that particular antibiotic. It's why the very broad spectrum antibiotics that, you know, kill most forms of bacteria have the biggest impact and the worst side effects. But giving antibiotics to children, that's a difficult decision because we've learned that it may help them, you know, with an ear infection or a sore throat. But the price that we pay, it potentially the increase in weight and the increase potentially in cancer. Too many courses of antibiotics might increase the risk of breast cancer in women. And we know that antibiotics administered to children also tend to increase their weight. And, you know, so you have to wonder, what are we doing? You know, we'll you know, fix the ear infection, but am I making my kid fat? You know, that's a very important idea. And, you know, there may be some remedies. In other words, after the antibiotics, some ways that you can recover the normal bacteria quicker. For example, taking a probiotic supplement after a course of antibiotics and then feeding those probiotic what they need to reproduce and improve their levels in the gut. That's usually fiber. You know, things like beans and berries and bran, which are the substrate, the fuel that these friendly bacteria need to grow and reproduce.
So the probiotic could be billions of cells of things like Acidophilus, Lactobacillus.
Sure, but billions aren't trillions. In other words, you've got to boost the billions up to trillions, and the way to do that is to feed them. And they eat fiber.
Ah, because how many did you say we have bacteria? 100 trillion.
Yeah,
that's a lot of feeding.
Being in the ocean, you know.
I wanted to go back to what you just said because parents really need to hear it. Obviously, if you need an antibiotic, you take it. Yeah. But for an ear infection, I know my dentist taught me about a natural sweetener called xylitol. Xylitol, he said, is also good for inner ear infections for kids. Xylitol kills off bad bacteria in your mouth that can travel to other parts of your body, and you certainly don't want it to travel to your heart. And xylitol is also low glycemic, so it's even safe, I understand, for people who can be diabetic. So what is your thoughts on xylitol?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, if you're going to be, let's say, chewing gum or something, it's certainly better than having a sugar in your mouth because you're just going to give yourself cavities. And the xylitol may have the opposite effect, and that is it doesn't just protect against the cavities, but it may help to prevent the growth of these bacteria that are living on sugar, and we know those are, you know, a big part of the picture with tooth decay. So I think it's a great idea. It's something that, you know, kids that might have not an ideal diet could potentially have a chewing gum with xylitol that might help protect their teeth from the bad bacteria and therefore cavities. It's a good idea.
And also, you can use a toothpaste that has xylitol in it, is all natural. A toothpaste that doesn't have any of these microbeads, supposedly, that can get in your teeth and also pollute the environment. But I also use a nasal spray. It's called X-L-E-A-R, X-Clear, which has xylitol, because it would seem like the first line of defense to not get a cold would be your nasal passages to keep them healthy and clean. What do you think of that?
In other words, using a probiotic of some kind in the nose or in the mouth. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. You know, we'll probably see more of that, you know, in the coming years, especially with the antibiotic age, because antibiotics change the bacteria in the nose also. And how do you improve those and get the healthy bacteria back? It's something that we need to learn more about for sure.
In order to get the good bacteria about, let's talk about there's an elimination diet where you eliminate the things that the bad bacteria feed on, and those are?
Well, I mean, the two are sugar and fat. I mean, those are the things that will really encourage the growth of the wrong bacteria in our gut. And so any diet that includes, you know, too much sugary foods or too many fatty foods, you'll notice that that not only, you know, changes the bacteria, but you'll notice a change in the bowel habits, because then it's, you know, more erratic, more irregular, not as good a movement as if the diet is low in sugar and low in fat.
And also, you want to have the fiber in the diet for a good bowel movement.
You got to have the fiber. And, you know, there's two kinds of fiber. There's one called soluble fiber, but there's a very important kind called insoluble fiber. And for the health of our gut, we need both. And the best places to get the two kinds of fiber, and they come together, would be in foods like beans. And all the beans are high in both kinds of fiber. So whether you like chili beans or black beans or red beans or garbanzo beans or peanuts or split peas or lentils, those are all excellent ways to get added mixed fiber. The next category would be berries, the blueberries, strawberries, cherries, boysenberries, blackberries, goji berries. They're all excellent sources of fiber. So that's another good way to get that fiber that we need. And then adding bran, you know, bran, which is the hull, the husk on the grains, that actually provides most of the fiber.
And also flax seeds?
Flax seeds, an excellent way to get fiber.
Rather than the oil. One of the books that you wrote was called Ultra Longevity, and you wrote, quote, "The best way to live a long and healthy life is to get your immune system functioning at its peak." And that being exposed to dirt when you're a kid is actually good for your immune system?
Yeah, I mean, today, unfortunately, you know, we're not as dirty as we used to be. And I think we're paying the price because we're seeing more allergies and more asthma, more autoimmune diseases. And there may be a solution just by getting exposed to more dirt when our immune system is learning what it should be reacting to. And the amount of dirt that we eat seems to be a pretty important factor in helping to train the immune system.
So you're a doctor telling me to get dirty.
That's right.
Some dirt.
And, you know, you can do it by, you know, eating fresh fruits and vegetables. That's a good way to get dirt. Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays when you buy veggies in the grocery store, they've been washed and maybe bleached and possibly even zapped with radiation to sterilize them. And it's just crazy. I mean, we never did that before when we had gardens, you know, in our yards. And so just, you know, washing these foods off a little bit is fine. We don't have to sterilize the food before we eat it.
But if a food isn't organic, if it's got pesticides and pesticide residue, that's not what you want in your body.
No, ideally, you'd want to be buying foods that are, you know, natural, that haven't been heavily sprayed or processed. And, you know, I know that's hard, and it's more time-consuming. It's more expensive to do that, and I know it's more difficult. But there might be some particular foods that you should spend the extra time and money to get organic. One good way to know is by knowing the Dirty Dozen list, which is published by the Environmental Working Group every year. And it includes the 12 crops that are the most heavily sprayed. And there are things like, you know, apples and celery and potatoes. Those are some of the most heavily sprayed crops, berries, strawberries, blueberries. And those are the ones where it's actually worth spending a little extra money to get the organic variety. And you can download the Dirty Dozen list for free. That's an app now for your phone. And when you do, it comes with the Clean 15 list, which is the list of 15 clean fruits and vegetables that really don't require organic because they're not heavily sprayed. Things like mangoes and papayas and pineapples and things are on the Clean 15 list. And so it's worth having both of those when you go shopping so that you know where to, you know, focus on spending the extra money.
There was a recent study that talked about the combination of chemicals that we're exposed to every day, whether it's in our air, the water, the foods, the cleaning products, or whatever. And I've always said maybe it isn't any one chemical that could increase your chances of something like cancer. But what if it's the combination of everything? And it really gets you to think about, I mean, we're exposed to it. What can we do to reduce it? What are your thoughts on all these chemicals and how much people should take charge of their well-being and consciously try to reduce their exposure?
Well, I mean, it's a toxic world, and it's impossible to avoid everything that we get exposed to. And, you know, do I think these chemicals are good for us? No, in no way I do. And that means we, you know, should be trying to reduce our exposure to the level that's possible. You know, unfortunately, it gets difficult if you're living in the real world to, you know, avoid exposure. It's really just too rampant to stay away from. There's some simple things that I think are worth doing. You know, one would be to filter your water. Not enough people are filtering their water at home, and you could use something as simple as a filtering carafe where you pour tap water through a carafe that has an activated filter in it, and that does a reasonable job at filtering out chemicals and some and most of the particulate matter. Some people have installed, you know, more high-quality water filters for their drinking water at home, and I think that's especially a good idea if you live in an area where the water supply might not be as good. I think for those dirty dozen foods, it's worthwhile spending a little bit of extra money to get the organic variety if you're buying those foods. I think it's always important to think about the things that we're putting in our bodies, whether they're, you know, medications, supplements, foods, preservatives, pesticides, all of those things that we can ingest. It's important to be more mindful of those things. And even the things that we might get in the course of normal eating. For example, if we are eating too much tuna fish, you're probably getting too many contaminants from the ocean, because a tuna is a big ocean-going fish, and it tends to, you know, accumulate.
Well, also, if you're not, well, I'm thinking about hormones and antibiotics that are in maybe the chicken, the eggs, the meat, and if you've got children, and I just wonder always, and children are exposed to this from the time they're very young, you see young girls developing breasts at an early age, and how much is that due to the hormones that are in the meat, the eggs, the milk that they're consuming?
Yeah, I mean, that could certainly be a part of the picture. I think the other thing that we're seeing is, you know, more calories and, you know, generally better nutrition than we've seen in the past, and that seems to be accelerating the development of puberty in young girls. And that's not a good trend, because we know that has also been linked with more reproductive cancers. So it's tricky. I mean, you know, we want our kids to have good nutrition, but not, you know, too many calories, and getting healthy foods, but not too much in the way of processed foods or chemicals. And, you know, that's a challenge for us.
Well, so would you advise people with children to do whatever they can to see that the kids are not getting the hormones and the antibiotics? Because the antibiotics eventually will affect our own resistance to antibiotics, and the hormones that are in all of these food products are affecting our bodies as well.
They can, and I think to the level that we're able to, yes, it's important to try to get, you know, foods that are free of those chemicals. So, you know, for example, they do have hormone-free or antibiotic-free classes of these, you know, meats. You can get antibiotic and hormone-free chicken or beef, for example. You do pay a little premium to get that. But I think, you know, especially, as you said, for a young family, it may be worthwhile.
We mentioned a little bit before about elimination diet. I just want to go over that again, because in addition to the sugar and the fats, what about the wheat, dairy, alcohol, the effect that that has, if you want to really know what's going on with your gut bacteria?
I think, you know, for those things, you're right. They do definitely have effects on gut bacteria. I mean, just imagine alcohol. It's a sterilizer. I mean, you put alcohol on things to kill germs, and if you're drinking a lot of it, you're going to be changing the bacteria in the gut, no question. You know, how that really plays out in each individual, we don't really understand yet, and that's part of the problem, is that there may be a lot of individual variation in the kinds of bacteria. And generally speaking, you know, the bacteria that we get, we actually inherit from our mother. That's the source that they come from, and they may change over the years based on antibiotics and diet, for example, but we get our first bacteria from our mother. And after that, our diet has effects on changing the kinds of bacteria. But the point is that we might want to take a hard look at our family history and decide if the bacteria we have are the ones we want, or if we should be making some changes based on our family history and what happened to our parents.
So we're getting some of that bacteria when we're born, when we're going through the vaginal
canal. That's right.
Canal. What if you have a C-section?
Well, then you don't get the mother's bacteria unless you're in one of these new birthing centers where they're taking vaginal swabs from the mother and painting the baby's faces at delivery so that they're getting the mom's bacteria instead of the nurse's.
Wow, that is really something. So you want to, well, obviously you want your mother's bacteria to be good.
Well, I mean, maybe
bacteria.
You'd have to choose. You're right. Not everybody would, but, you know, generally speaking, mothers would want their kids to get theirs, I think.
Yes, I think so. So if, I know you put people on an elimination diet to see if they're sensitive to food. So that would be like a 30-day diet where you try to eliminate wheat, sugar, dairy, alcohol.
Well, let's say somebody's having problems. They're having, mm-hmm, either digestive symptoms, or they may be having you know, difficulties with inflammation, or they may be having some autoimmune or skin problems. You know, one thing that's worth trying is an elimination diet to see if food might have an impact on that condition. And so I think, you know, a 30 or 45 day process as an experiment, there's no harm done if nothing happens, but a lot of people have had, you know, benefits. For example, maybe their psoriasis gets better, maybe their diarrhea improves, maybe their gas and bloating gets better. And then it becomes a bit of detective work to figure out, you know, which of those foods were really culprits in causing the problem. But, you know, it's interesting. You may have quite a learning experience by trying kind of elimination diet.
It's a challenging experience. So for 30 days, you're not giving the bad bacteria what it loves and feeds on, which is wheat, sugar, dairy, alcohol. So for 30 days, you also need to give them the things that they don't like. So probiotics being one of them.
Yeah, I think the probiotics and, you know, the fiber is a good one, because what's really going on in the gut, it's germ warfare. You know, some of the bacteria are fighting with the other bacteria. And, you know, who wins is pretty important, because we want the friendly guys to win that little battle in the gut. And we want to help them win that fight and take over by feeding them what they need to grow and reproduce. And again, that's generally these two sources of fiber.
Okay. And what about, I want to feed my good bacteria, what about the garlic that we referred to earlier? Is that a helpful thing?
Well, garlic may have some specific effects for reducing inflammation, for example, and blocking some of the inflammatory compounds. So garlic may be, you know, a medicine or a food that acts as a medicine, for example.
And what about something that I've taken called oregano oil extract? How does that work?
Yeah, oregano oil is a very powerful antimicrobial, and it's particularly effective against the world of fungi and a host of bad bacteria. And so oil of oregano becomes a great antimicrobial and one that might help to shift the balance in someone's gut if they have a problem.
Okay, so for those 30 days, I also take whey protein, which has something called immunoglobulins. Explain that.
Well, immunoglobulins are antibodies, and those are coming from the cow. And whey protein, of course, is a protein that comes from cows. And, you know, for some people that works well, as long as they don't have whey or, you know, dairy type of sensitivity. There's different types of protein. You can get whey protein, you can get wheat protein, you can get rice protein. So they're coming from different places generally. And certain people, you know, do better with one or the other. That's something that you might have to experiment with to see which one you feel best on.
So at the end of the 30 days, you begin to introduce like a little bit of wheat, and then another day a little bit of sugar, or another day a little bit of alcohol or dairy or whatever. And then by your body's response, you get an idea of what your body might be sensitive to?
Yeah, I mean, we'd like to reintroduce the foods first. I know probably somebody is dying for that glass of wine, but it's probably better to wait until you're eating a regular diet before you start reintroducing, you know, the alcohol, for example. But sometimes when people go back on a food that they had eliminated, for example, it might be, you know, you said gluten. And then when they reintroduce the gluten, they immediately feel ill. For example, maybe they'll feel bloated or gassy or queasy, or they might break out in a skin rash. You know, that's a good sign that, you know, gluten is a problem for that individual. In other words, they've just done a little experiment on themselves with gluten, and, you know, they flunked the experiment, and that would be information that would be helpful, because now that person should keep avoiding gluten.
Well, for me, the one time that I did the diet, I think I missed most the sugar, the sweets. I mean, I was doing alternative kinds of things. And when I went to reintroduce the sugar, I was going to wait another day or two. And I was at a restaurant and the waiter served he said, "Oh, you've got to taste the creme brulee." And I just took one taste and I thought, she's back with the sweets. No, I know. I try to eliminate, you know, as much as I can. But there's something about dessert. But I only eat the desserts when it really tastes really wonderful. If it's not a great dessert, it's not worth the calories. It's not worth the sugar. Better to save it for a good dessert or a good piece of bread, whatever it is that is quality. Mark, things I want to close with Dr. Gaynor, he had said in terms of eating the right foods to prevent cancer is like wearing a seatbelt to avoid being killed in an accident. That's how he compared it. I think so many people really, we don't think about it. It's normal. I mean, I'm not perfect all the time and I like my sweets. And last night I had some eggplant parmesan, which wasn't usually on my diet, but I enjoyed it thoroughly. Sure. Can't be perfect, but what percentage of the time is it okay if you're good 80% of the time? Does that make a difference?
For most people, I'd say if you're not dealing with any health issue, 80% is probably good enough. If you have a health condition, diabetes or, you know, blood pressure, heart problems, you better bump that up to 90, but I still think 90 is close enough for almost everybody.
What would you say, you know, in summing up the two parts that we've been doing on taking good care of your health and also the importance of food and diet and exercise and sleep. We talked about that in part one, because if you're not sleeping well, that affects your well-being. To kind of motivate people to don't wait till you get sick. It's no fun. Do most people even know how good being healthy can feel if you've just been going along for years, just kind of, you know, okay.
You hate to get to that point where you have a wake-up call and you have to make a change as opposed to being able to make a change at your discretion. So it's always better to be proactive around these things, not wait until you have a problem, but proactively improve things to improve your health.
Just talking to you is always wonderful. There's so much to learn and there's so much to know. I thank you always, Dr. Mark Laponis. And another time we'll talk about your book on the Hunter-Farmer diet solution, because we need to know about that as well. Just a quick encapsulation and a tease for the next conversation with you.
Well, sure. I mean, we have plenty more things we can talk about. The idea of the hunter-farmer diet is that if people eat the proper diet for their own metabolism, they'll have better results in being able to control and maintain their weight. And when you read the book, you realize that there's two basic different types of metabolism, one that's insulin-sensitive and one that's insulin-resistant. And knowing which one you have, which you were born with, will help you to make better decisions about what to eat.
Well, now I know for part three when the next time is. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks,
and sharing all this information, which is incredibly important. As I always say, be the CEO of your own well-being. Take charge of your most important assets. It's the best investment you can possibly make. And for those of you who would like to check out GoodForYouNetwork.com, which is all about what are you doing now that's good for your own well-being, and what are you doing now to contribute to the well-being of others. You can share your own stories with us, and you can tweet us at GoodForYouNet. You can follow us on Facebook at GoodForYouNetwork. And if you have any ideas for programming or any questions that you have about any aspect of well-being, you can always email me at Claire@GoodForYouNetwork.com. I'm Claire Carter. Thanks for joining us, and this is Good For You Radio.